I want to read again from Carol's book, Elements of Hope. Some of you asked about the title yesterday. The book is simply called Elements of Hope. The author is James Carroll. The binding is atrocious. Mine is coming apart, but it's on sale, I think, in the bookstore. I don't know how many we have, but you may want to get it. The Corinthian letters are very difficult letters, and yesterday we experienced some of that difficulty in one way. Today we're going to experience that difficulty in a different way. And I want to read a difficult poem to start us off. This one is called The Experience of Alienation. One potato, two potato. In the last 50 years, three potato, four. We normal, good-meaning men, five potato, six potato, have slaughtered by our own hands, seven potato, 100 million of ourselves. If we could feel that truth, remove it from this page, make it more heart than history, we would be changed enough to dull the edge of annihilation that waits to destroy us all. Is it any wonder that we are alone, untrusting, as afraid to live as to die? Is it any wonder that our new name for violence is love? How many times have I killed you out of fear that you would eat my bread, which then went stale since I could not eat it all alone? If you are a man, chances are I compete with you and may destroy you in my need to win. If you are a woman, chances are I murder you with fantasies, part mother, part maid, lover enough to ease my stress. If you are a child, chances are I resent you already. If you are old and tired, I have forgotten you, likely, in your attic room alone. The chances are good, all of them, because I am as normal as you are. Don't you know that it's a fool who plays it cool, Lenin says, when his soul is freezing? We have a great future, they say, but then we have always had. You and I know how far the future is when you go there on your knees. It began, the story says, by loving too little a single tree. We know how to waste the earth, to ruin its soil and ravage its forests, to poison its air and pour filth into its rivers. Loveless nature gave us floods, tundra, tombs, deserts. Loveless men gave nature famine, pollution, war, and thirst, mass-producing death, technologizing scarcity of love. We know how to waste everything. What we do not know is the name of one of these 100 million dead. Could we but take him in our arms and say, you are mine, you are me? Could we stop saying then, I regret, but what could I do? Your death is modern war, the economy at work, power balancing. Who are we to embrace our victims? Who are we to get up from our knees and be awakened to the world? Who are we to change death into life? Who are we to talk at all of love? Who are we to wait for God? Yet, who are we to say it is hopeless? If there was a time, and it is not past, when we could slap each other's fists, singing one potato, two potato, hearing even then about Earth's apples, three potato, four, without masquerades of love, five potato, six potato, though the dreadful had already happened, seven potato, and we knew it, who are we to lose? That's a poem about a lot of things, annihilation and love and jealousy, and I suppose it may be a good introduction to Paul on sex. I think these three chapters, 5, 6, and 7, are some of the most difficult aspects of the entire letter to the Corinthians, but difficult in a different way from yesterday. Yesterday we understood, in a sense, what Paul was talking, the foolishness of the gospel, but it was a hard word for us. Today, it's difficult because his perspective is so foreign to our way of thinking. One of the things that we need to confront when we deal with the New Testament is the vast cultural distance between ourselves and the New Testament. There is one sense, I suppose, in which we can say human existence has certain tremendous continuities throughout the history of human existence. But there is another sense in which culture determines the way in which we are and the way in which we think and the kinds of things that we do. We do not today, for example, send wives and slaves along into death with great leaders so that they will have their accompaniments, their consorts, and their servants with them in the afterlife. We do not send food and war weapons along with our dead because of what they will need in the afterlife. In that sense, we function quite differently than many of our ancestors. We have less in common, in many ways, with people who lived 400 years ago than they had with all previous human history. The chasm that separates us today culturally from everything prior to the Enlightenment is an enormous one. And that confronts us particularly as we try to get behind the kinds of things that Paul is saying here, the conceptions out of which he argues. I'm going to quote a little later from E.P. Sanders' book, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, and I'm not recommending it. It was the 1978 National Religious Book Award winner, but besides the fact that it cost $25, most of it is really a reassessment of Palestinian Judaism. But he has a marvelous section on Paul, several hundred pages, and his conclusion at the end of all of this is in many ways a depressing one. He says, to an appreciable degree, what Paul concretely thought cannot be directly appropriated by Christians today. And we're going to see that in its most explicit form in these chapters. Let me take a look at them. I'm going to divide them into two. Chapters 5 and 6, I think, dealing with one set of problems, and then chapter 7 with another. Chapter 5 begins with an incident that Paul had reported to him, probably also again by Chloe's people, that is, Chloe's slaves, whoever they were. They got over to Ephesus, and they were telling Paul some things. And what they told him was that there is immorality among you of a kind not even found among pagans, for a man is living with his father's wife. Now, this is not incest, at least as nearly as we can tell. It's probably that a man married or at least was living with his stepmother. And this was forbidden in both Jewish and Roman law. But what shocks and angers Paul most is not the fact that this is going on, but that the congregation has not acted on it. And how should they act? They are to expel him from the congregation. And you are arrogant. Ought you not rather to mourn? Let him who has done this be removed from among you. Now, I think that this understanding of what should take place here is the key to the next two chapters. Because if we look at it in terms of the paragraphs, every one of those paragraphs has to do with Paul's concern that they have not expelled this guy from the congregation. Look at verses 3 to 5. For though absent in body, I am present in spirit, and if present, I have already pronounced judgment in the name of the Lord Jesus on the man who has done such a thing. When you are assembled and my spirit is present in the power of our Lord Jesus, you are to deliver this man to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. I'm going to save comment on each of these until the end, because I want us to get the sort of force of what Paul is saying and then try to ask what lies behind it. Look again now at verses 6 to 8. This used to be the epistle for Easter Sunday in the old annual lectionary. Every time I had to preach on it up until we got the new lectionary, I always thought, what in the world are we doing here lifting this one little paragraph out of what is really a terribly difficult section and making it the key reading for the greatest festival of the Christian church here. But now we've got better lessons, and there are better lessons in the New Testament. This one, still in the context of saying, get rid of this guy. Your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little yeast, a little leaven, leavens the whole lump? Cleanse out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you already are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Paul's point again is, out with this guy. Get rid of the old leaven. 9-13, I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with immoral men, not at all meaning the immoral of this world, the greedy, the robbers, the idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world, but rather I wrote to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother, if he is guilty of immorality or greed, or is an idolater, reviler, drunkard, or robber. Whew! Not even to eat with such a one, for what have I to do with judging outsiders? Is it not that those inside the church whom you are to judge? God judges those outside. Drive out the wicked person from among you. See what Paul is saying here. Now, it looks as if in the next section, 6:1-8, he is adducing a new topic, and partially he is. He is saying, in a sense, don't go to law courts for judgment. But notice that this still fits in with the notion that they are to make the judgment and get rid of this guy. Which one of you has a grievance against a brother? When one of you has a grievance against a brother, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more matters pertaining to this life? If then you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who are least esteemed by the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no man among you wise enough to decide between members of the brotherhood? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. To have lawsuits at all with one another is defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud, and that even your own brethren. Paul is, in a sense, here operating with a new topic. He says, better to be defrauded than to go to law courts. That's a hard word. That goes back to yesterday's foolishness of the gospel passage. But he is trying to say to them again, get on with the business of judging. And then verses 9-11. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Notice this list now. Neither the immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor homosexuals, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor revilers, nor robbers will inherit the kingdom of God. And such were some of you. But you are washed, you are sanctified, you are justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and in the Spirit of our God. And now then, the last section, 12-20. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both one and the other. The body is not meant for immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I therefore take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who joins himself to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two shall become one. But he who is united to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Shun immorality. Every other sin which a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, which you have from God? You are not your own. You were bought with a price. Glorify God in your body. We can summarize this, I think, very simply by saying that people who engage in some sexual acts are to be expelled from the congregation because those sexual acts establish unions which exclude the individual from union with Christ. That's the point. Now I think we have to ask, what in the world lies behind this? What kind of conception or what kind of worldview lies behind this kind of understanding of Paul? And it is a worldview that is closely related to his understanding of Christ and of the redemption and of the gospel. There are two conceptions that come to expression here. The first is that the world or the universe is controlled by two competing powers, two lordships, the power and the lordship of Satan on the one hand, and the power and the lordship of God on the other hand, who has acted redemptively in the event of Jesus. And the second conception is that all human beings participate in one or the other of these two lordships, that they are united with, that they are members of, literally members of, one or the other. The closest that we can come to finding some kind of parallel for Paul's very concrete vision here of this kind of union with one or another of these competing lordships is guilt or redemption by association. See, and if you put it that way, then you begin to see how alien some of this is to our way of thinking. We are in many ways appalled by the notion of guilt by association, you see. If I happen to have a friend who was involved in political corruption, but I myself was not involved in it, and I am punished for just that friendship, we would say there's something wrong with that. Or if I have a friend who is a banker and the banker is suddenly discovered to be an embezzler, and then everybody says, well, we're not going to trust you anymore either because, look, this embezzler was your friend. See, we are appalled by that kind of a notion. But that isn't even a strong enough notion yet to say what Paul has in mind. And this is where I want to quote Sanders, because this is practically the whole point of Sanders' argument in attempting to understand Paul. Pages 454 and 455, I have it right here. The argument is that one participatory union, Sanders says, can destroy another, even though the two are not on precisely the same level. He's now talking exactly about Corinthians here. He says, the RSV omits from the quotation of Genesis 2:24 the word flesh, but Paul indicates that a union of flesh can destroy a union of spirit. That Paul did not actually think of humans as divided into flesh, spirit, and soul is well known. But the point he's making is, a person, the whole person, cannot participate in two mutually exclusive unions. The argument is introduced to clinch the point that Christians should not engage in sexual immorality. And here we see the ease with which Paul moves to a conception that strikes modern human beings as quite remarkable. The argument about sexual immorality is based on facts about a participatory union, which Paul supposes his readers will immediately understand and agree with. Do you not know, he says, everyone agrees so readily today with Paul's conclusions, Christians should not commit sexual immorality, that we easily miss how strange the logic behind it is for us and how natural it was to Paul. We might expect an argument that a Christian should not behave in such and such a way since immorality is not appropriate to being a Christian, since it is forbidden in the Bible, or since such a transgression will result in punishment from God. But to say that one should not fornicate because fornication produces a union which excludes one from a union which is saving is to employ a rationale which today we can hardly understand. But the participatory union that Paul is talking about, union with Christ, is not a figure of speech. It is Paul's understanding of reality itself. The event of Christ, Paul thinks, has introduced a changed lordship. And by baptism and by the sacraments, we are literally made one with Christ, so that what happens to him happens to us. Good, you know, all the good and all the bad things about that. That is, as he was crucified, so will we be. As he was raised, so will we be, because we are linked with him. But if we involve ourselves in another kind of union or lordship, we will be excluded from Christ, and therefore we have to be excluded from the congregation. The question posed, how long ago now? Almost 30 years ago, by Rudolf Bultmann. Almost 40 years ago, by Rudolf Bultmann, I think is still the question that we have to wrestle with. To what extent is the message of the New Testament tied to the worldview of the New Testament? Let me just sharpen the problem a little bit, and then maybe we can have some time to talk about it. If we agree with Paul that some sexual acts are wrong, for example, marriage of a man to his stepmother, or prostitution and fornication are wrong, must we agree with his basis for this? You see, that the reason why it is wrong is because that particular kind of sexual activity involves us in a union, a linkage, a membership, which excludes from the union or the linkage with Christ. And if we do not agree with that basis, you see, if we're going looking for some other basis, does that help to explain why we don't act on Paul's conclusion, namely, expel people who do things like that from the congregation? I don't know how many of you here remember the last excommunication in your parish for activity of this kind. Huh? Anybody? Well, I mean, we aren't doing this, all right? So why don't we do it, you see? And if we do not agree with the basis, then I think we have the task of saying, on what other basis then, if not the one that Paul gives, on what other basis do we want to say certain sexual activity is wrong? To try to use the Bible as a guide for this is a very tricky business. Back when I was teaching at Concordia Teachers College in River Forest, we had a program by which certain faculty members were assigned to dormitory units to provide pastoral care to various dormitory units, and one year I was assigned to be the chaplain, sort of, to the freshman girls' dormitory. And my responsibilities consisted of being available to these freshman girls for pastoral care of various kinds. But one evening a week we met for sort of general discussion, usually Thursday evening, and the Eucharist. And we talked about a lot of things, usually problems of faith or problems of getting along with one another as roommates or floor mates in a dormitory. But one evening they said they wanted me to talk about the whole question of why certain sexual activities were wrong. We are fooling ourselves, I think, those of us who are adults, if we do not think that that there is a fairly significant degree of sexual activity already among teenagers and still more among college people. And some of these girls had come to me and said, we are having sexual activity with our boyfriends and we don't see anything wrong with it. Will you talk about this? Well, I went to the Bible naively, assuming that I was going to get all kinds of good advice out of the Bible. Well, what did I find there? My goodness. I found, first of all, that the Bible seems to accept bigamy and concubinage, that Esther's way of becoming queen was not parading before Ahasuerus in a bathing suit, that Ruth has a euphemism. I think it's lying at the feet or covering the feet. for sexual intercourse with Boaz before they were married. That the New Testament, even up to the time of Jesus, seems to permit levirate marriage. That is, where a brother, even if he is already married, is obligated to marry his brother's widow so that he can have, so that she can have children in the brother's name. All of this stuff in the New Testament, up to the in the Bible, up to the New Testament. So it's very difficult to find a kind of single vision of sexual activity in the New Testament that will help us to sort our way through the question, on what basis are we willing to say today that some kinds of sexual activity are wrong and other kinds not? Unless we are willing to, in a sense, go back to the worldview with which Paul operated, but then we are really saying that faith in the gospel means also faith in a worldview. And there are people who are prepared to say that. I'm not, but that leaves me with other kinds of dilemmas. The last question that I want to raise, and mostly I've got questions when it comes to dealing with this. The last question is the whole problem of homosexuality. Yesterday I tried to say that if we were in the world today as Jesus was in the world, then part of the way we would be in the world is in a sense to associate with the same kind of unpopular people that Jesus associated with. One of the most historical items in the Gospels is the criticism of Jesus' enemies that he was eating meals frequently, apparently, with the corrupt politicians, the tax collectors, the publicans, and the prostitutes. That doesn't mean that he was condoning, but he was at least associating with. Paul says here, don't have anything to do with people like that, for these people do not belong to the kingdom. But he includes in that list all kinds of other people. The immoral, the idolaters, the adulterers, the homosexuals, the thieves, the greedy, drunkards, revilers, robbers, none of them will inherit the kingdom. Now, I don't notice any great movement in Topeka, Kansas, or St. Paul, Minnesota, to write into the laws of the city that drunkards cannot teach in public schools, or that the greedy do not have civil rights, or that, it gets very sticky, you see, if we're going to try to enact into legislation the kind of thing that Paul is talking about here. It gets even stickier if we're going to try to make this the practice of congregations. Well, what I want to do is raise these questions. Do you want to stop here and talk about this a little bit, or do you want to take a look at Romans 7 first? I see a hand. We'll stop and talk.
Hey, we've got a couple of things. Paul stating one thing, and you take a look at Christ and what he said, and his actions seemingly just the opposite of what Paul is stating here. Mm-hmm. For example, in Matthew 18, mm-hmm. 15 and following, if your brother sins, you go and deal with him. Again, you know, you get down to that final section. If he doesn't hear you and doesn't hear the church, then out with him.
Mm-hmm.
And the exclusion was for their salvation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's a paradox. We get down to this last section, you know, the thief, the prostitute, the publican will not inherit the kingdom. And yet Jesus associated with these, forgiving the thief upon the cross, mm-hmm. who accepted him, Matthew the publican, Mary the prostitute, all of these.
And even said they'll get into the kingdom ahead of the rest of you. Yes.
Okay, how do we deal with this? You know, we're talking here, on the one, it's very judgmental.
Yeah.
It seems to be excluding this whole aspect of Christian love.
See, and you're right, and the point I'm trying to make here, the question I'm trying to sharpen for us is that Paul has an understanding of what it means to be in union with Christ, and that understanding leads him to say other unions are excluded by union with Christ and vice versa. So if you got a person who is involved in a false union, exclude him from the congregation. That's the conception.
Don't we deal with him, though?
Well, Paul isn't saying anything like that.
That's the thing. We're not dealing with him as Christ seemingly dealt with that individual.
I guess I'm trying to say, can we... maybe there are two questions here. One is, can an apostle be wrong? And the second one is, can we separate Paul's gospel from some of the stuff that he's saying, you see? Or from some of the underlying conceptions behind what he is saying. That's what I'm trying to get at. Now we got hands back there. You're just sharpening the question a little more, yes. Did everybody hear that?
No.
Oh, she said, is the congregation or the church for sinners or for saints? Yeah, please.
Verse 5 in the 5th chapter, does it mean by that if he was brought to, examine himself, then he would... the Spirit would be again in him, or does he mean by that too?
I have a note here that says, membership in the church protects one from Satan's destructive power. This man does not deserve such protection. Once excluded, he will be subject to disease and death, but there is hope that his soul may be saved in the final judgment.
That one verse kind of...
That's the note. Yeah, that's the note at least that the Oxford Bible has here. And it accords with everything that Sanders was saying, that because he is here marrying his father's, his stepmother, apparently his father is dead, or maybe there's been a divorce and so he's married his stepmother, that he is now to be delivered over to Satan. He is under a different lordship, and therefore to be excluded. I think that's what that verse is trying to say. Please, Jay.
I'm a little uncomfortable because I'm not sure when we compare Jesus with Paul that we're, in the terms of Jesus, it seems we were talking about entrance rights in the kingdom, and Paul's talking about maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me we have to keep those two issues, because if you talk about excommunication within the community as a means I'm thinking back to the Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
And in the town journal, it talks about Lydia Wyndham, who upon the birth of her first illegitimate child was chastised by the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And it reads, upon the birth of the second bastard, as it reads in the journal, she was severely warned. On the birth of the third illegitimate child, she was... excluded for 2 weeks. On the birth of her fourth, she was excommunicated.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes on to say that a year later she met and married Harold so-and-so, and upon full confession to the congregation was re-entered into the life of the community.
Mm-hmm.
With joy and celebration.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about, it seems to me, entrance rights on the one hand and preservation of the community on the other, and there's two different issues.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the way we're running.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. I mean, that's a helpful word, but it also seems to me that that there is a sense in which the conception underlying what was going on in the Gospels and in Jesus' activity was not fully identical with the conception that underlay Paul's proclamation. I think I'm only beginning to think about some of these things, but it seems to me that Jesus does not express himself in the kind of language that Paul does. And part of what Sanders is trying to do is to untangle some of this stuff. There is a sense in which Paul operates much like the mystery religions of the ancient Near East, who had this same sense of participation. That does not seem to have been present in Palestine and in Jesus' worldview. So that even though we could, on the one hand, say there's a difference between initiation and maintenance, and I would agree with that, on the other hand, we are still not quite off the hook as to whether or not the underlying worldviews here, in Jesus' case and in Paul's case, were identical. And that's the more difficult problem to deal with. Please.
I see a difference, too, in that Paul had been a Pharisee, was steeped in learning, or was an elite, part of the religious and educational elite of his time, and Christ lived with common people, and I see him coming from very different places, too. And,
possible.
You know, that Paul might have had this worldview might have been more of a pharisaical, that he was more legalist for Paul than for Christ.
Possibly. Please.
I'm getting a taste coming back in my mouth of yesterday morning's conversation.
All right.
And that the word elite brought the taste back in. Well, the conversation we're holding here now isn't 1900 years later in a direct parallel between what type of conversations might have gone on 1900 years ago in Corinth over the very same subject, that might two different groups of people have held two discussions along totally separate lines similar to what we're discussing here now.
Yes.
And both been right.
That would be nice. Please.
That the Jesus stories about him associating with these folk, the point of those stories is that their lives were changed. Here in the, at least in the New English Version, that heads this section, Unity and Order of the Church, Paul is not addressing changing in lives. He's addressing what this embracing says about our church, that we are, by embracing it, encouraging it, instead of asking them to be changed or expecting that there's change involved. So I think there's two different points entirely between the
We're still faced with the necessity, I think, of asking the question, on what grounds can we appropriate, or on what grounds can we develop, maybe, a Christian sexual ethic? If we do not accept, let's say, the grounds out of which Paul argues, on what basis can we have a Christian sexual ethic that will help us to decide whether or not that a change has in fact taken place? Please.
I see these this particular instance as parallel in a way with the Ananias and Sapphira situation, because in that situation there were other Christians who were called Christians who didn't sell all their property, but the point was that they had said that they had sold all their property. And they had wanted to identify themselves with the Christians on a false basis. And somehow, to me, this parallels this situation, where this man is very aware, I'm sure, of the ethic of the Christian community, but flagrantly, in the face of that kind of realization, he is trying to identify himself with the Christian community and at the same time flaunting that community ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is more to the point than the particular ethics involved is the kind of falseness on his part.
Okay.
And I think that's very consistent then also with Jesus and his emphasis as over against the Pharisees, who were also trying to identify themselves with the kingdom, but at the same time being false and basically dishonest in their attempts to do this.
Yes, and in a sense, what you're doing here, and I guess we have to be conscious of what you're doing, you are appropriating the material here in a way that is persuasive for us today, intelligible, that helps us, in a sense, to link ourselves both with what was going on back there and with our own contemporary understandings of Christianity and world and morality. You're saying that the key issue is that they're trying to be part of the community on a false basis as opposed to, let's say, a true or honest basis. That's a set of ideas that we can operate with. That's something we can understand. What's more difficult for us, however, is the arguing that Paul does in this section on prostitution as involving, literally, a totally different union of one's being with something that excludes union with Christ. We have to contrast this, just to cite one example, with Dostoevsky's use of Sonia in Crime and Punishment as a prostitute who is a very redemptive figure, a very redemptive person. And Dostoevsky is operating again with a different underlying conception of what is involved in forgiveness and grace and the gospel than the conception that Paul is operating with. Please.
You used to hear the story from the mission field when, for example, polygamy was being practiced among the natives.
Yes.
And then a person took a Christian stance, and then what was he supposed to do with his other three wives?
Yes.
Abandon them or leave them out to the birds or whatever it was you did when you left those people. So then, transplanting that illustration here, when we're starting out experientially, and today in the 70s, experience is the name of the game. If you haven't experienced it, don't knock it. So then you have people come into the fellowship, perhaps saying, I want you to baptize a lifestyle to which I've already committed myself.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps Paul is saying, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to baptize what you've already committed yourself to. There's going to have to be some change in what you've committed yourself to. And we have made some of those changes, and we hope maybe you will. But meanwhile, we're not going to totally lay it on you, because you are being baptized into, and that's a process that's going to take a while.
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe there's a mediating ground here. We know we're not going to kick you out, but we're not going to have you come in here and say you're married to your mother-in-law, and that's acceptable to us either. Because you're in the process of being redeemed and sanctified just like we are, and we don't see clearly what your relationship ought to be, but it's, maybe open to some questions. Mm-hmm.
Let me just move us on to 1 Corinthians 7, and I'd like to summarize just for a moment where I would come out on this. I think I would come out on two places. The first is that I can't agree with some of the worldview that's involved in Paul's line of argument, but I would agree with at least two of his conclusions. But I would agree with at least two of his conclusions. One is that there is such a thing as a valid sexual ethic, and we have to find a basis for it. And secondly, that the Christian community can in fact be a discipled or a disciplined community, which involves some exclusion. That is, it involves a point at which we finally have to say, this kind of behavior really testifies to your exclusion from the Lordship of Christ, and we have to signal that in some valid way. I guess I come out with agenda for us in all of this. One is, we've got to do some work on providing a basis for a sexual ethic, but we probably will have to argue differently than Paul does. That's agenda. And the second agenda is, we've got to ask, how can we restore something like discipling or discipline to the Christian community? We don't seem to have it now. Dropping people from membership roles doesn't really carry much of a message to anybody. But let's go on to 7. Just a couple of things here, otherwise we're going to be behind. Paul makes, I think, 2 points in chapter 7. We haven't got time to read it all, but you can read it for yourself. The first point is, it's better not to have sexual relations at all. There's no way you can read this chapter without getting that conclusion from Paul. Let me just cite a bunch of verses here. 7:1. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well for a man not to touch a woman. Now he's saying this just sort of generally, because look at the context. But because of the temptation to immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. In other words, he's saying, even if you're married, it's probably better not to have sex. But if you're tempted to immorality, well, okay. And then he goes on to say, the husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband, for the wife does not rule over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not rule over his body, but the wife does. An astonishing conception, in a sense, given that time and place in history. Do not refuse one another, except perhaps by agreement for a season, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again, lest Satan tempt you through lack of self-control. I say this by way of concession, he says, not of command. And then verse 7, again, but I wish all were as I myself am. But each has his own special gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. Phew. To the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is well for them to remain single as I do, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to be aflame with passion. Near the end, he takes this theme up again. I want to go to 36 and 39, the last two paragraphs in this chapter. If anyone thinks he is not behaving properly toward his betrothed, if his passions are strong, and it has to be, let him do as he wishes, let them marry. It is no sin. But whoever is firmly established in his heart, being under no necessity, but having his desire under control, and has determined this in his heart, to keep her as his betrothed, he will do well. So that he who marries his betrothed does well, but he who refrains from marriage will do better. A wife is bound to her husband as long as she lives. If the husband dies, she is free to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But in my judgment, she is happier if she remains as she is. And I think I have the Spirit of God. Okay, so it's pretty hard to read this chapter and not get the message. Paul doesn't think that one should be married or to have sexual relations. The second point is, the married should stay married to each other. No divorce. And that covers a whole bunch of stuff which I'm not going to read. Again, the question I ask myself is, what lies behind this? And what lies behind this is now a third notion that we have to add to the other two. the first two notions behind Paul's worldview were that the universe is controlled by competing powers, by competing lordships, Satan's and Christ's, and secondly, that all human beings participate in one or the other of these by association, by union. Now the third notion is the world is going to end in his own lifetime. And therefore, he says, it's better, you know, don't change too much. I mean, he's got more stuff in here. He says, if you're born a slave, don't change anything. If you're married, don't get unmarried. If you're not married, don't marry. Stay wherever you are, everything in place. It's not going to go on much longer. The world is going to come to an end. Paul literally lived with the notion that it was going to happen in his lifetime. We are 2,000 years later. The world has not come to an end. And the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what does that mean for us today? In short, can an apostle be wrong again? You know, not only can he be wrong in the advice that he gives, but can he be wrong in some of his own basic understandings? Didn't, if he was inspired, didn't he know that the world was going to go on and on and on? Doesn't God know that at least? What's Paul operating with here? Not a full deck or something? Or to put it another way, what does it mean for us to live without necessarily acting as if the world were going to come to an end? Again, let me just suggest at least a couple of ways for us to think. As we get towards the end of Corinthians, I want to ask, what does it mean if we know, how would we live if we knew how history was going to come to an end, even if we don't know when or whether, and don't act as if it's going to come to an end in our own lifetime? In other words, I think it's possible for us to live with the end in view, that is, knowing how the play is going to end, even if we may be in the second act instead of the fifth act. And I think that's what we will see towards the end of this letter. But right now here, Paul is, I think, mistaken. The world didn't come to an end, and at least the advice that he gave, everything in place, is the kind of advice that I would find sort of difficult to take. But the second problem, I think, in Paul here is really, in the last analysis, a lack of appreciation for the gifted quality of sex. And I guess I have some difficulties with this chapter because of that. I think he's really sort of saying, well, the ideal way to be is pay no attention to the gift of sex at all. If you can stand that, if that's the best way to go, it's certainly the better way. I don't know what this means. I think it involves us with a couple of problems. Can we cultivate a sexual ethic again that treats sex as a gift? And secondly, what does that really mean for singles in the world today? I don't know that Paul has the last word for them in this chapter either. And I'm uncomfortable with both of these chapters, really uncomfortable, partly because I sort of feel compelled to say apostles too can be wrong. And my whole piety and background and upbringing and everything else makes that a very difficult thing to say. All right, now we're open again, please.
Well, having been a converted Catholic community, I've just recently joined the Catholic Church. The priest, I've struggled with this whole issue of the celibate and what is that all about. I mean, there's a book called The Sexual Celibate, and he sees that celibacy is a gift, as is family life and sexual relationships.
Mm-hmm.
To me, Paul is speaking out of his idea about himself. And that when I read anybody in the scriptures except Christ, I have to say, well, where is he coming from? What's his interpretation?
Mm-hmm.
Right for him? He had to organize and build his church, as this fellow said, as a maintenance problem. But for me, I have to see what I'm called to. But I think I'm troubled that he creates this either or.
Mm-hmm.
But in that, in knowing homosexuals as friends, we have a friend that, that we went to visit one night. He was loaded. He'd been drinking since 7 a.m. We met him in the church community through prayer groups. We cooked the dinner he invited us to come to. It was really, he lifted a turkey out of the oven with no pan and the grease. We had to wash the floor. A week later, he invited me to have coffee with him. He didn't show up, so I went to his house. He was drunk again. And we had coffee in the tab right nearby. And out of my accepting him, he started to talk about homosexuality, which I suspect he is. And he said, you know, God abhors, and this is a committed Christian, homosexuality. And he looked like he was just in anger. And I said, and he also abhors manipulation and gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a deepening of that relationship. But I couldn't have excluded him. We had to invite him back. And to me, the kingdom that he talks about, that you leave to join the other side, that's within. That if I participate in too much behavior that is not a calling of Christ, I become more in the other side. But it's somehow blending of the two. I don't know.
Cool.
Yeah, I think that's a heart-rending story, and I hear you saying, at least in part, you have some difficulties too with Paul's either-or. Please.
How much of an understanding of Paul here comes among the idea of sexual dualism of the Hellenistic world, the idea that, you know, the spirit is good, the body is bad, if you are rational, mm-hmm. and the mind is the sort of thing that you need. The more rational you are, the better you are, the less you get rid of the emotions, and that the that kind of separation is Paul operating with. I'm reading a book by James Nelson on that, and he struggles with how much is Paul into that kind of notion.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that Paul is strongly influenced here by that kind of separation of mind from body. All of the commentators, at least that I've been able to read, and especially now this stuff by Sanders, persuades me really that Paul is operating with different lordships. He has a sense of the unity of the person that's evident throughout. I think that's been argued repeatedly. Paul does not operate with parts being bad and parts being good, as the Greeks sometimes did. He's operating with a whole person, but it's a question of lordships, of whom one is in union with. That's his primary concern. Please, back.
Verse 5, though, in chapter 5, when he talks about the destruction of the flesh that the soul might be.
Yeah. Paul's understanding of flesh is, again, I think, a unified one. I mean, it is the total person involved in a false union, and his understanding of spirit again is the total person. I don't think that that's that behind that lies Hellenistic dualism. I guess I have to go by the way he uses flesh and spirit in other letters. Romans would be a good example. Marsh?
Yeah. Could it be that in the first chapter that you read, that possibly part of the point, at least, is that anything that could separate a human being from God is bad, whether it's some kind of sexual problem or anything else. He's going into sexual problems there and other things. And that it's not really a different concept in that chapter as any other chapter that's dealing with the same topic. And I'm going to say something I'm not sure I agree with entirely.
Good.
Taking that, extending that, a person's own, how would someone else be able to tell a person whether they're separated from God because they're doing something? The concept you were talking about that Christ ate with sinners, that I couldn't tell someone else that because they're homosexual that they're separated from God. How would I know? That's kind of a private thing, whether someone's separated from God or not. And this is the part I'm not sure I agree with. That as you were saying, that we have to come up with some kind of sexual ethic for ourselves. If what I was saying earlier is true, then it kind of opens up the door to almost anything.
Yes.
Provided someone is not separated from God. That's the important thing. You're not separated from God. So where is the limit there?
Yes, and if each of us were to judge that for ourselves, of course, nobody would ever think of himself as separated from God. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there are people that feel that at times...
All right, most of us wouldn't. Yeah, most of us wouldn't.
Well, a lot of people don't have the sense of well-being about themselves in that sense. I'm not even sure it was most. I think there are times when a lot of people feel very separated from God, and I think there are times in almost everyone's life that they have felt separated from God. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think there are times in people's lives.
Possibly. Isa? I'm going to give Isa the last word, because it's time for us to break.
I'm still struggling with that question of the either-or of Paul's worldview, and I started hearing Jesus' words that you can't serve God and mammon, that you've got to make the choice. And I'm wondering, if part of our resistance to accepting Paul's worldview is that we don't like to be told that you can't have a foot in both sides,
mm-hmm.
either in sexuality or in greed or in idolatry or in gossip, that we really are called to a very definite ethic.
Okay, that links us, I think, once again, that's a good word, and I think it links us once again with yesterday's discussion. Because the problem that I face is not so much with Paul's either or. I think that we need to take that seriously. The problem I have is with how one gets to the conclusion. I mean, his conclusion is, first of all, not to kick the guy out. His conclusion is, one must either be under one lordship or under another. I think I even agree with that. And I think I would also say that Christ's lordship excludes other lordships. But how does one get to that? How do we argue towards that today? What is the basis for that? Bultmann tried to say the basis for it is a change in self-understanding. That's helpful, but I don't think that it fully deals with the problem. He was trying to say, how can we appropriate Paul today? That's sort of where I'm left with after reading these chapters. I want to appropriate both Paul's insistence that the Christian community really has a character to it, that it stands for something. That Christianity does not simply bless and baptize everything that's going on in the world. I want to appropriate that. I don't think we're doing a very good job of it. I also think that we need to have a viable, persuasive sexual ethic for our time. And we don't have a very persuasive one right now. Neither Christians nor Playboy provides us with a viable, persuasive sexual ethic. Christians, because we're sort of living with our heads in the sand, we're not really recognizing a lot of stuff that's going on. We're still having weddings pretending that sexual activity begins with a marriage ceremony, when everything tells us it doesn't. So we're not dealing with it. But I don't think that the alternatives that are being offered us today are really all that helpful. I think they're destructive. But I read Paul and I try to say, give us some help, and I don't find it as helpful. Maybe that's the final conclusion. I don't find it as helpful as it could be. I've tried to ask why, and that's where I want to end this morning. I'm sorry that this has been so difficult. I wish I could make it easier for you, or I wish we could make it easier for one another. But I don't think we can, and we're just sort of stuck with some very difficult material in Corinthians. It'll get easier tomorrow, all right?